For the week of April 5th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 488, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, way more than 6 feet away from Sperling, I'm Michael Gills. How are you feeling?
Well, you know, it's funny you should ask that question. And no, this isn't going down the coronavirus COVID.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, thank goodness. At least I don't think so. Just, I don't know whether I had a UTI, a urinary tract infection, or a kidney stone. But this weekend, I've never been so happy to hopefully have a kidney stone.
It helps to have a doctor in the house, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Right. And so you were given antibiotics and that has helped you feel a lot better. And therefore, that's a strong indication that you did not have coronavirus because a virus wouldn't care about antibiotics.
A virus looks at antibiotics and says, ha, what else do you have?
Exactly. So that's the good news. The bad news is you're now feeling great. You're getting recovering. The good news is you're getting better, you're on the mend, you're getting treated. You probably didn't have coronavirus. We're almost certain of that, at least according to the expert medical opinion of your wife. And we're going to have a show.
Yes.
So what will we talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we do not have a guest. So that's our bad. We're going to run through some news, try not to pontificate too much. Already too late for that, and let you get back to spending more time with, I don't know, your family, perhaps. Wait, what? You're looking to get a break from your family? That can't possibly be. Well, don't worry, because, you know, we'll probably go on too long anyway, which we've probably already
keep
done.
Going.
Okay, well, in China, we've gone from bad news to good news to bad news to good news again. This week's good news? TV and film crews are back at work. That is very good news. On Inside Baseball, we'll cover the disturbing news at The Hollywood Reporter, where executive director Matt Bellany has resigned. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll discuss a few of the week's top headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Gilts to fill us in on last week's, and I cannot believe I'm about to say this, video on demand charts.
Hey, that's a big business. I've had people pitching me for the last year or two. Can you give customers and people updates on, you know, video on demand releases and, you know, all that? I'm like, I got no outlet that wants that information. Well, we do now because it's the only game in town and there's a lot of money being made. There always is in video on demand. People who rent movies or buy them, via this video on demand. So what's going on this week? Well, we have
you say people want them. That's fine. But the problem that we've always had with them is that what does it really mean? It's like 2% of patients. Like, well, how many patients did you have?
Right. They wanted us to say what was coming out this week. I covered for years DVD and Blu-ray. I covered Laserdisc, then DVD and Blu-ray for decades. And so every week you'd say what new stuff is out, and you'd review the good stuff or the bad stuff and give people advice. People wanted me to do that with new releases and video on demand. So there's a market for that. It's very confusing. People don't know what's available where and when. But we're talking about the money being made by them. And for that, we have no information. All we have is a chart that lists them in order saying this is the most popular one this week, but we don't know how much money it made. So it's sort of a black hole of information because the studios don't want us to know how much money they've been making historically in this area.
Yeah, it's like, oh, wow, 1917 was on top. That means it could have sold 10 copies.
Right. Or a whole lot more. And the same would do for DVD and Blu-ray. Once in a blue moon, they would say, we've sold 1 million copies of this DVD, or this movie grossed $100 million on its opening weekend availability on DVD. And we'd say, wow, we sure love that information every week. And they'd say, yeah, goodbye.
Yeah, and you know, those are actually, I can tell you that once in a blue moon was, let me translate that for non-entertainment industry. I'm sorry?
Maybe once or twice a year they would provide actual dollar figures.
I can tell you exactly when it was. Every time Disney released an animated film on DVD, then they'd tell you, because it was always 26 million, 50 million copies would go out immediately.
Well, that's out pushed out to stores. That's not the same. No, I remember XXX. I remember them telling us the information on that movie when it came out on DVD Blu-ray. That's my memory, which is, of course, faulty. All our memories are. But I remember that, I think, grossing a lot of money on its opening weekend availability on DVD. But again, it happened very rarely. So here we have a list of the most popular things, movies, really, this doesn't involve TV shows, movies that people have accessed via video on demand. Number one in North America, this chart is not for the world, just North America, is 1917. And this is for 2 weeks ago. This is not the previous week, but 2 weeks ago. It's the week of March 23rd through March 29th, because this information takes, I don't know why it would take longer to come out. They're not giving us much data, so you'd think it'd be quicker. But anyway, it comes out slower. We're talking about 2 weekends ago, what were the most popular movies for that week? And the most popular movie for people stuck at home was 1917. And number two was Jumanji, The Next Level. At three, Knives Out. A good, pretty family-friendly for most kids, you know, older teens and kids. At number four is Just Mercy, the anti-capital punishment movie. And at number five is Bombshell, the movie about Fox News. So you can watch Fox News, or you can learn about the manipulations going on at Fox News if you watch Bombshell. At number six, this is the only movie on the chart that is not a new release. It is Contagion. The Steven Soderbergh film was at number seven last week. It's moved up to number six, which may mean it even made less money. We don't know, but we know it's popular and it's still moving up the charts. People are still sort of watching with black humor. How bad could it be? Let's watch this film and see if we can endure it. At number seven is I Still Believe, a faith-based film. And number eight is the Will Smith animated film Spies in Disguise. And number nine, lower than Spies in Disguise, is Frozen 2. Maybe everybody bought it that first week, or maybe they rented it immediately, and so they don't need to rent it this week. But it's a little surprise to see it lower on the charts this week than Spies in Disguise. It's only been 2 weeks it's been available.
And you know why I think
it
is?
And it wasn't number one when it came out either. This is the movie that's really highly priced. Is that what the deal is?
No, I think it is because you can get it on Disney Plus. So I think people have subscribed to Disney Plus, and therefore there's no reason to do
it. So is it already available on Disney Plus?
Yes, that was their big thing. They pushed it early.
Right. I knew they pushed it early, but I didn't know it was available on Disney Plus at the same time as video on demand. So you've looked at it on Disney Plus? You've seen it there?
Oh, yeah. No, that was their big announcement is, you know what? We wouldn't normally do this. It was supposed to be on Disney Plus 3 months from now. So here you go. We're pushing it 3 months early to Disney Plus. You know, we're sorry about the shutdown and the quarantine.
Well, number 10 is Richard Jewell from director Clint Eastwood. So going back to Frozen 2, that's an early indication of why you would hesitate before you do stuff like making your whole library available on subscription streaming service. The fact is, you had a good business for many decades of people buying your stuff every time it came out on Blu-ray and DVD. Parents knew their kids would watch it over and over and over again. So you said, you know what? I want that $20. I want that $30 that you would get when people bought a movie to own it. It's a heck of a lot better than that $2 that they would pay to rent it from Blockbuster. But now they're saying, I can get you to pay $6 a month, every month, for like the next 20 years or until your kids grow up and you decide you don't need Disney Plus anymore. That's a better business, they believe. And they're sacrificing that short-term money they could be making via video on demand or Blu-ray and DVD sales for that constant money coming in from all the people who subscribe to Disney Plus. Will it pay off? We'll have to find out. But that's certainly the reason, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. And I think what they're going to do is because everybody said, well, how long are you going to really need to subscribe to Disney Plus until your kids are like 15? Then you can dump it. Well, I think, thank you, Marvel. Thank you, Lucasfilm. I think they're going to try and make it so that eventually it is for both the kiddies and the adults.
Absolutely. I mean, Mandalorian is not for little children as such. You know, you can watch it, I'm sure, with pretty young kids, but it's a family-friendly show to a degree, but it's really for adults, I think.
I have two words about that, okay? Uh-huh. Two words. Ready? Mm-hmm. Yoda, baby, put them in any order you like.
Adorable. It's true, that's adorable, but still, I think that's a show that appeals strongly to adults. You're not watching it just to keep your kids company. It's not that good a show. It's okay. Actually, I watched the whole thing. The last three episodes improved quite a bit. I would give the show like 2.5 out of 4 stars. It's probably a little generous. It was okay. I thought it was actually a little cheap looking. Maybe we discussed this already. I don't remember.
You know what? I'm remembering less and less because each day seems like a week.
Exactly. So who knows? So I give a cautious, tepid recommendation to The Mandalorian. If you're already subscribing to Disney Plus, you've already watched it or you're going to watch it, I assume. It's not bad.
You know, we don't get those VOD numbers, you know, like exactly how much.
No, of course not.
Yeah, is being made or how many people are buying it, not even a, you know, audience size. Apparently, we're not getting any numbers from the DGA either.
That's true. That's right. In our roundup of news, it's true. The DGA contract has been approved by its members in an overwhelming number of votes. So the DGA put it to its membership for votes. They voted on it and they supported it overwhelmingly, said the DGA. Well, what was the percentage or what was
They got 11 ballots back and 10 of them were a yes and one was a no. That's overwhelming. Yes.
Yes. So we don't know the actual numbers, and that's a little unusual, I think. Maybe they always keep their personal votes private, but I'm used to seeing membership votes being given in actual numbers and in percentages. And in this case, all we're being told is no, trust us. It was overwhelming. But that has approved, and so that's going to move forward. So that's good news in terms of people who think they got a good deal and we don't want to strike. And in this day and age, of course, everybody's getting a forced strike from work, and so they're all eager to get back to work with good new contracts that they can support. Who knows what's going to happen with the WGA, but I'm assuming they'll want to get a deal done, but they're not going to want to sacrifice a long-term future, but they're already paying a heavy price with the shutdown. So it's going to be really hard to gin up excitement and enthusiasm for another strike when we just get back to work. That really, right, psychologically will be very hard to do. So I think there is a little more pressure on the guilds to, you know, okay, if hopefully the DGA got a good enough deal that the others will feel like they can build on that and accept that, and that will be a good step forward. At least do a contract for a year. Maybe they'll say, let's just do a 2-year contract or something. Who knows?
Well, I want to know the lawyer or agent or Matt, whoever negotiated Joe Ianiello's contract over at CBS. He was the former chief of CBS. I want that guy. He gets paid $2.8 million per year his salary in 2019, but his severance package somehow is $125 million.
No, that's not true. His pay for 2019 plus his severance package plus his stock awards for 2019 totaled $125 million.
And so, look, at the end of the day, does it really matter? He just got $125 million.
Yeah, and he got fired, but it wasn't just for being fired. That was also part of the, you get $10, $20, $30 million in stock awards when you're a top exec at some of these multinational media companies. So he did get $125 million walking away from CBS in his final year. A lot of that is his normal annual pay. And my point is saying, look, his actual salary was just, I'm putting that in quotes, just $2.8 million. You know what that is for most people? Winning the lottery. Win $2.8 million, you get to have about $2 million after taxes. And that's a damn good salary for the next 20 years. More than 90% of the people in this country make. You can pay yourself $95,000 a year for 20 years after taxes when you get $2.8 million. That would take me to my mid-70s. I'd be a happy camper. And that's a drop in the bucket. So when top execs say, I'm taking a 15% pay cut in my salary along with all my employees, take that with a grain of salt and think, yeah, I'm not impressed. Tell me when you're getting zero, stock awards. Tell me when you're getting zero compensation beyond your salary and you're taking a pay cut in your salary, which is already a lot of money for most people anyway. So,
I get all of the, because of Celluloid Junkie, I get all of these emails that are investor emails. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them are just SCE. They are forced, these companies, whether it's AMC or Cinemark or even a Universal Studios, they are forced to send out press releases or SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, notices, mm-hmm, when certain things take place,
right,
when they release an annual report. Also, when people buy stock, when,
right,
they give, when
or,
they give
or
stock
sell.
Or sell, when they give stock to board members, when they give stock to employees, or when their options are up and the employee exercises them. And I look at this sometimes and I'm like, oh, that's John Doe. That's the CMO, the chief marketing officer for AMC or whoever it is. And oh, wow, they're getting 450,000 shares.
Ooh.
Right. That's a lot of shares. And I'm making numbers up now. Mm-hmm. But then you look at, well, how much are they paying for those shares? Because they're trading at $6 a share.
Right. And they're paying $4 or $3.
No, they're paying zero.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then you're like, oh, well, I know they have to keep them for a certain amount of time, like usually about a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it's not a capital gain and then the taxes are ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But still, let's say they keep it for a year and a half and it's just the same exact price. That's some you know, umpteen thousands of shares at $6 per share that they paid zero for.
That's called money. Money in the bank. That's right. And Disney thought they had money in the bank with Artemis Fowl. This was a big franchise that they were launching. It's based on a series of best-selling children's books or young adult books, I guess. It's sort of middle grade, really, I think is where Artemis Fowl sits. It's directed by Kenneth Branagh, who has experience in launching and helming big franchise movies. This was a movie Disney had high, high hopes for. Now, what's happened?
Well, what's happened is, remember that scene in that Far and Away? Remember that scene? Now, this was the
Tom Cruise, Nicole Kidman film?
Yeah, the Irish one. Where
I don't remember any scenes from that film whatsoever.
I remember one specifically, the Oklahoma Land Rush scene where they, you know, basically are racing. You know, they basically, the gun goes off and all of these people are trying to go out there and stake their claim. They plant a flag in their homestead saying, "This piece of land is mine."
Right.
Well, that's effectively what's happening in the film industry right now. You have a whole bunch of studios that are going out and saying, "I claim this weekend in 2021. Well, I claim this other weekend in March in 2021.
Right. So they've got big stuff and they're moving it to new release dates, which they always do. They're bumping release dates down the road. Untitled movies had a release date. Now they're moving a film that was supposed to play in the summer of 2020. Now it's moving to the summer of 2021 or Christmas of 2020, and then something else is moving to 2021. You know, yeah, it's a constant game of you know, leapfrog.
Right. And so what you're seeing here is, well, some have said you're seeing Disney's lack of enthusiasm for Artemis Fowl. What you might be seeing...
You've buried the lead, for God's sakes. They've taken Artemis Fowl and they've pulled it from theatrical release and they're going it straight to Disney+. It's a $125 million movie budget and they are just taking it to Disney+. Just like the Trolls World Tour animated film, that was a high budget film. That's the biggest example previously of a movie going straight to streaming because of all this upscale. Now we're seeing Disney taking Artemis Fowl and doing the same thing. Now explain to people why it's a big deal.
Well,
do you think it shows a lack of confidence in the film?
A lack of confidence. They basically looked at the film and they said, "We have no date for this. We can't find a date where it would work. And you know what? It's probably not a great movie. Let's put it on Disney Plus and let people watch it for free. And it'll be one more thing that people, you know, show up for."
Yeah, I don't think there's any other way to spin it. They could have just held on to it and said, "We'll release it in March of 2021. It wouldn't be any less of a evergreen, you know. It's a launch of a new franchise. I'm sure they had high hopes. They may also have been some thinking that they've, you know, the people can't even buy the merchandise anyway. There may have been tie-ins to, you know, fast food joints and toys and merchandise in stores. I'm sure there are some, but of course, people can't go to the store and buy that anyway. And all that stuff would have had to sit in a warehouse for a year. But if they really were excited by this movie and thought it was going to launch a franchise, I can't imagine they would put it to Disney Plus. It doesn't mean Disney Plus is the home of junk and things you don't care about, but you'd already spent $125 million on this movie. It's supposed to launch a franchise. There's a string of books behind it. Clearly, you had the expectation of at least two or three or four films and then maybe a TV spinoff series and who knows what. So this has to be a sign that they're not thrilled with the quality of the film. But
well, think about it this way. You spent $125 million on the film. Do you want to spend another $100 million marketing the film when you
normally,
know it's
yeah.
probably...
Yes. Normally, well, yes. You know, not good movies not... do well at the box office. It happens
yeah, that's
all the
true.
Time. You know, so they, you know, maybe they're hoping to see a big bump in attention for it on the service. Maybe they'll see it's wildly popular and say, "Great, we'll do a TV series spinoff." Or maybe the second film will be theatrical. You know, anything's possible. It doesn't mean it's the end of Artemis Fowl, but clearly they had big hopes for it. And skipping the theatrical when so many other people saying, look, a big movie with a big budget that's going to launch a franchise, that's not the sort of film you say, "Hey, let's go straight to streaming." You do that for a mid-budget, a smaller budget movie, or a movie that has some sort of timely hook or some other reason. You know, when it's a big, big movie, you're not going to skip theatrical.
Well, you know, The Lovebirds, which was Camille Nanjiani and Issa Rae's comedy over at Paramount, that went straight to Netflix. That was, you know, I'm sure Paramount didn't necessarily cry over it, but that also, they had a co-financier who said, "Look, we need to get our money, so we're just going to sell everything to Netflix because they're going to basically get us out of this movie."
Right, that's a 86-minute romantic comedy. It was going to be put out by Paramount, but instead it went right to Netflix.
Right.
You know, so there you go. I mean, I don't know what the budget for the film was, but I'm assuming it was in the $20-$40 million range.
Who knows? Yeah.
Probably. So that again is a film where you say, all right, we can gain attention for it. It's got a low ceiling in terms of how big it was going to be. And so we'll just say, hey, it's a quality film. We can put it out there. People will see it. It can be hugely popular. We can make, they offered us enough money. We can make it,
Well, I know one of the big questions everybody has, whether you're in the entertainment industry or not, is when does life return to normal? And the answer is pretty much never. It never returns to normal. We will be marked with this for the rest of our lives. But in China, they're slowly getting back to work. And by getting back to work, I mean the Chinese film and television industry, that the productions have gone back to work. And a part of that is because they can control that. They can control how many people are on set. They can control how they're on set, whether there is still some distancing going on.
Not while you're filming a scene, what every crowd scene in the movie. I don't understand how this is happening. We know of shows, TV shows like the very popular series, Like a Flowing River, that's back at work. Zhang Yimou is filming a spy movie called Impasse. Those are just two of the many films and TV shows that have gone back into production. Just a week ago, they said, we can't have people in movie theaters next to each other. How can you make a spy film where your hero is walking through a crowd? How can you do that safely?
First of all,
it's not possible.
We don't know that there are crowd scenes in that film.
Unless you're in room with a mother and a child trapped in a small room. People are not 6 feet apart in every scene in a film. That's ridiculous. Of course they're next to each other. Of course there are crowds. Of course there are groups of people in a conference room talking, how are we going to get this man? I mean,
well, we're also talking about in a country of 1.4 billion people, two shows or two productions.
No, two of many shows. These are not the only two shows, but I don't see how even a single show could be shot safely. That's my question. I don't understand why or how they think this can be done safely. Are they going back too soon like they did with
movie theaters?
And they said, no, hold on a second. That was too quick. I don't know, but I have my suspicions. It doesn't seem like, they're at a stage that you could do this safely, but what do I know? But I'd love to have more information. If you know what's going on and you can share some info about how they're doing this in a way that keeps the people safe, let us know.
Dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. Again, that's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. So if you know something, let us know. Or you can call us, leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7266. Of course, we're on Twitter. @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
And hey, it's no big deal if you don't email us or reach out, but you could still rate and review us on iTunes. I wouldn't kill you, would it? You've got nothing but time.
That's true. Literally. Now, speaking of time, we said we'd keep this show down to 10 minutes. We've already failed at that.
Yeah.
But should we move on to Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense?
I think we should.
Well, then let's talk about Paradigm. Like many agencies, Paradigm has been firing or furloughing or both all of their employees. But, not so fast, says Agent Debbie Klein. In a $2 million lawsuit, she says they just entered a binding oral contract agreement saying Klein could be fired only for cause. Plus, agency head Sam Gores reportedly praised her recently as the company's best agent. Klein is best known for putting together Black-ish, its spinoffs, and other shows in recent years. So an employer-employee spat, maybe? Well, it doesn't stop there because the lawsuit alleges all sorts of misbehavior by Gores, including sexual dalliances with prostitutes, with company money, corporate funds used as a personal piggy bank, Gores self-sabotaging a big bucks deal for the company to be bought by UTA, rampant sexism, and unrewarded loyalty, among other charges.
Paradigm reports that the lawsuit is false, frivolous, and scurrilous. My goodness.
And to which I say, I really hope you get a bigger dictionary because I'd love to hear what other words you yank at it.
Scurrilous, I say. Scurrilous.
Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, but hey, be careful who you fire when they know where all the bodies are buried. That's what I could say. And as far as agents using company money to have sexual dalliances with prostitutes, I think that was known as business as usual in the 1980s. So
yeah,
it's how sad that I look at that and go, yeah, I'm sure that's true. It's sad enough to be sexual dalliance with a prostitute, but to hear that and think, oh, yeah, I'm sure he did that. That's the world we live in, where you think, yeah, that's probably true. So not good. Hopefully she has the evidence to back it up. But it's going to be an interesting case unless, of course, they settle out of court.
Right. And you know, Harvey Weinstein right now is saying all he gets is a lawsuit. That's it. I got 23 years in coronavirus.
Well, that was not sex, you know, consent among adults.
Yes, I know.
Yeah. Well, jokes about Harvey Weinstein. Too soon.
Too soon. Well, okay. It's not too soon for Tidal. The music streaming service is offering a special rate so you can shelter at home and still jam out to your favorite music and Tidal exclusives. Right now, people can subscribe for just $1 a month. Plus, you get a set of Ginsu knives. I'm just kidding. You can subscribe for $1 a month for 4 months before a full subscription price kicks in. So that means you can now hear Jay-Z's new electronica album immediately. And by the way, it's not an electronic album.
It's an album called Electronica. Very confusing.
Exactly. Similarly, disgraced comic Louis C.K. just posted a new stand-up special on his website to download for $8 called Sincerely Louis C.K. It's available, they say, for, quote, those who need to laugh. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. On the Tidal website, it doesn't talk about, for people who need to shelter at home. But since multiple websites use that wording, I'm assuming that was their press release. And this code ties into my idea that all these people saying, look, we want you to sign up for our service. We're trying to do it in this time of crisis. We're coming together. BS. Louis C.K. If you need a laugh, like, yeah, thanks. You're such a charitable man. You know, give me a break. You people are trying to make money and piggyback on an emergency to do it. Just be honest about what you're doing. People offer, you know, introductory offers. They want you to sign up, put in your credit card, and then forget to cancel it 4 months from now when it goes from $1 to $10 or $15. So the real people offering stuff and doing it genuinely are like HBO, who are offering free programming, access to everything, including every episode of Sopranos, Veep, Six Feet Under, and The Wire, just for free. Yeah, you got to use their app, okay, but they're not asking to sign up or give you their credit card info or, you know, have it so that 3 months from now, if you forget, they're going to start charging you $20 a month. No, they're just saying, let's make it for free. It's good PR for them. It's good introduction to their service to make you say, wow, look at all this great stuff. And if I subscribe, I'll get access to even more. And maybe I want to keep watching it. So they're not doing it purely out of the kindness of their heart. But at least what they're doing is clean and clear and not this BS. Just sign up for $1 a month. We love you. You know, give me a break.
Do you know what I think it is?
What?
I think they're hoping that you get like 4 seasons into Sopranos or
right.
The Wire,
something
like
that.
And then like the shutdown is lifted and everybody goes back to work and they say, okay, well now that, you know, this is over. So we're going to, you know, stop this. Right. And then you're going to have to subscribe to find out what happens to Tony Soprano.
They're not being saints, but there are no strings attached to what they're doing. If Tidal said, hey, you can play our service free for the next 2 months, that would be a fair thing where you could say we're trying to help or we're just doing some good PR work here and we're doing it without playing any games. That would be a fair thing to do. Yes, you download their app. Yes, you'd get a little info, but you wouldn't be tied into it and you wouldn't have to cancel your subscription 4 months from now.
What Tidal is doing in times of non-quarantine, non-coronavirus, is referred to as an introductory offer. It's right. Done all the time.
Exactly.
But now what Louis C.K. is doing, and he said he was going to be doing this long before the coronavirus epidemic.
Uh-huh. But tying it into it and saying, you know, who needs a laugh right now, you know.
Well, he said he was going to be doing it, you know, like basically in spring or summer. He's doing just that. Mm-hmm. He said, I'm doing another special because that's the only way I can make money. So he's done this before where he's basically gone straight to his fan base and said, here's my special. It's $8.
Yeah, he did it
you can download it.
He did it with his TV series too, but the timing and implying, in this time of crisis, I'm here to help. Give me a break.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day.
Dolly Parton, on the other hand, she's on YouTube for free reading picture books to kids, one book a week. This week she read The Little Engine That Could, and that promotes her brand, of course, and Dolly Parton, God bless her, adorable person, but it also supports the Imagination Library, the Imaginarium Library, whatever they call it. It's this thing that she does where they send out free books to newborn kids and their parents, and she's been doing it for decades. She's handed out, like, hundreds of millions of books, I think, for free to new parents and their little children. So it's a great charity she does. She's helping to support that, encouraging people to read with their kids, doing a great thing. So yes, that's free. It's clear. It promotes a charity. you know, it may burnish her image, but we can be free of cynicism on that one because they're, you know, it's only being done in a positive way that, you know, really does help people and give you something new to watch. So good for her.
Well, this means war. Yeah, well, that's what Activision said when it was sued over the company's hugely successful video game franchise, Call of Duty. The car manufacturer Humvee sued them for depicting their vehicles in contemporary war settings. Go figure! Activision said it had a right to accurately reflect modern warfare, including the equipment made by Humvee for the U.S. military. First, a judge ruled First Amendment rights come into play. Further, while Humvee may license its trademark for toys and games, that is not the company's primary business. So Activision can depict a Humvee, but not G.I. Joe.
For example.
As an example. Other issues raised were also dismissed for a very broad-based win. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's actually a big deal. It's an interesting case because it's obviously a private company. They make stuff for the military, but to say, hey, we've got other people. Maybe, you know, what's the Grand Theft Auto? Maybe they, you know, license Humvee cars and now you're using them for free. And they're saying, well, sorry, you make it for the military. It's a government procured equipment. We're depicting the current military accurately. And it's not a clear win, but it was a clear win in terms of the judge. I mean, you'd go, I don't know what they're going to say. But they came down very strongly in terms of free speech, in terms of the fact that in this context, it was fair use. So I'm always glad to see fair use come into play. It seemed like it was a good ruling, very broad ruling, and it seems reasonable. You know, if Humvee made toys and that was their only business, it would be a very different story. But they make cars and they do contract to the government, and the ones they make for the government can be depicted in a video game and presumably in movies and other areas where previously people had to pay Humvee a license. Maybe now they won't have to.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. We haven't had Inside Baseball for the past couple of weeks because, you know, it's all been corona, effectively. Mm. But just late breaking news today when we were sitting down to say, should we do an episode? There's hardly any news that isn't coronavirus related. Here comes Matt Bellany, who was, an employee at The Hollywood Reporter for 14 years in one form or another. He was their news editor at one point. He worked his way up to executive editor, taking over for Janice Min eventually, who was their editor. And he has resigned been pushed out from the magazine, which, by the way, is probably the 25 million visitors per month is the most widely read entertainment news publication. But it started out as a trade publication, a print trade publication.
Fascinating. Well, yes, he's out. He can say he resigned, but probably pushed out is just as accurate. They were butting heads, and according to The Wrap, it's over editorial independence. Now we've had stories in Variety and The Wrap, and things are starting to come out deadline about what was going on. Multiple outlets are reporting that the co-CEOs of the parent company kept interfering, right?
Yeah, effectively... And I'm going to mess up the names here, but Modi Weitzik and Asif Sachu, the co-CEOs of Valence Media, basically came to editors such as Matt Bellany and Kim Masters, who was an editor at large there, and said, okay, you can't cover the following companies negatively because we have ties to them, like Dick Clark Productions.
Well, we own them, yeah.
Yeah, please give them more... Right. Give them more press.
They say they wanted to spike stories, which they deny they ever spiked any stories, but that's not the same as trying to spike a story. They said it's been said that they were trying to block unfavorable coverage of their friends and businesses and were demanding overpromotion of companies they own, like Dick Clark Productions. They wanted them to glowingly cover every move of Dick Clark Productions as if it was an earth-shaking event. They also specifically ordered Billboard and Hollywood Reporter to never write any stories that might negatively impact their particular businesses, something that Bellany and editor-at-large Kim Masters actively protested against. They were having meetings. They were having teleconferences in which it's reported Bellany and Kim Masters were very upfront about saying, this is not acceptable to us. You can't do this. And Variety reports that they wanted to hand over a list of, like, you can't, it would be problematic for you to cover these people or businesses. which sounds crazy and ridiculous. And Bellany and Masters adamantly pushed back. Valance even enlisted Kelly McBride from the Poynter Institute. This is according to one report. If the claim in this coverage is that they were trying to get the Poynter Institute to back them up and say what they were asking for was reasonable. Now, the Poynter Institute has been working with Valance and or Billboard. I'm not sure who the relationship is with, but they have been working with them ever since the president of Billboard was fired for editorial independence. That person was reportedly trying to spike stories about their friends, which was a big blow up. And so Valance said, all right, we're going to bring in the Poynter Institute because that's a media watchdog. They specialize in media ethics. So we don't know what the Poynter Institute's involvement was at this point. The way it was described sounds exactly opposite of what they do generally, which is provide media ethic guidelines. And in fact, just today, Kelly McBride has been named the public editor at NPR. And that is a watchdog position on media ethics. It's like the ombudsperson. You know, they used to have that at the New York Times, someone that if you were unhappy with coverage, whether you're a reader or a person who was involved in the story, you call them up and say, I feel I was untreated fairly. And they look into it and give a public ruling of their, you know, opinion on what was going on. And they work with editorial sometimes, but they also provide independent criticism and or support. It doesn't mean they always criticize. Sometimes they say, no, I feel the newspaper did a good job in this case. So she's just joined that role at NPR. We're going to have her on next week on our show to discuss. Yes, the work of the Poynter Institute, her new position at...
Wait, you just sent the email before we...
Right, man, they rolled back and said, yes, we'd love to do it. So...
Oh, okay, like literally, just here's some sausage making in action for you. So I was all ready to go. We were going to start recording and I hear like this loud banging, tap, 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 tap. And I realize Michael's typing an email and it keeps going and going. I'm like, who are you typing to? He's like, she said, oh, Kelly, from the Poynter Institute, you know, I'm going to ask if she wants to join us. I said, oh, well, great. We'll have a guest, possibly if she says yes. But for every 10 guests you invite, you generally get a half of one. So, you know, you generally have to invite 20 guests to get a guest. And literally that was 5 seconds before we started recording. We have not stopped recording. And now I don't know how you managed to see that she wrote back to you, Michael, but it looks like, we have a guest for next week.
So the Poynter Institute is a great place. They do great work. I'm fascinated that NPR has hired her as their new public editor. That's a really important position, and more places like the New York Times should have or reinstate that position. It'd be great to talk to her both about what the Poynter Institute does and what her role is going to be at NPR, media ethics in general. I'm not sure if she'll be able to discuss specifically what was going on at Hollywood Reporter. She may be under some confidentiality agreement, but I assume in general she'll be able to discuss the ideas of the owner of a media company saying, hey, don't talk about my friends, and how that works out and how you work with them on that. So we're looking forward to having her on the show next week. And that ends up inside baseball, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And it moves us along into, first of all, I'd be interested to see what Matt Bellany does next, but this does move us along.
Oh, and I should say Kim Masters, you know, the fact that they did not name a replacement for him tells you that maybe he resigned, but this, you know, resigned/pushed out the door, or just was given such an untenable position. Who is going to take this job and say, yes, I'm willing to spike any stories you don't want, or yes, I am willing to take a list of people and businesses and not cover them? As an independent news organization, that position is now toxic. Who's going to take that? And the very first question they should be asked is those very questions. What is your relationship with them? Are they hands off? Have you been given any list or any people or any indication whatsoever that you will not have complete editorial independence? And if they're not careful, Kim Masters is going to be out the door. And she can get a job anywhere in the country because she's a great reporter. She's got a great track record. People will be dying to pick her up. This is really going to be a gutting of Hollywood Reporter if they're not careful, because if they try to put in some patsy there who's going to do what they want, they're going to destroy the reputation of an outlet that's been so important for the industry for decades now. So this is a really bad, crucial time for the Hollywood Reporter beyond what's going on. You've got the bosses telling them you can't cover these stories. You can't do the job you need to do. And who are they going to get in to do it? And if that person's there, how are we going to understand that they have the independence that they need? And who else is going to leave in the wake of Matt Bellany's departure? So this is an ongoing story for sure.
What isn't ongoing are some of the people in our obituary section. I know that's a horrible segue. I have yet to figure out a good segue into our obituary section, which I don't know when it started. I don't know how it started, but all of a sudden every week we're doing an obituary section. So Michael, you have listed 1, 2, 900, 901, 900. We have a lot of obituaries.
That's right. So we've got, you know, some people I wouldn't have necessarily included. And I said, wait, I'm a man. Don't think that a woman, oh, who cares about it? Well, actually, you know, we want to make sure we balance this out and remember the people, not have to go back 20 years from now and say, we should have covered this person. We should have mentioned them, because we're not always, they don't always have the same impact on you and me because of our gender or because of the area of the industry we cover or perhaps where we live. That's why I'm including actress and biographer Patricia Bosworth. She died at 86 of coronavirus-related complications. She was an actor in the 50s and 60s, including The Nun Story. Then she switched to journalism. She worked at New York Magazine, where I worked. She did award-winning articles like one on Elia Kazan. She worked for Tina Brown, God help her. And then she switched to doing best-selling biographies of people like Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clift, Jane Fonda, and Diane Arbus, who, hilariously, she posed for as a model early in her career. So that's a full circle. Being a model for Diane Arbus and then eventually writing a biography of her, that's quite the life's journey. I think that's pretty great. And similarly, in Australia, we have director George Ogilvy, who died at 89. He's been a major force in Australian film, TV, and theater. His name doesn't mean much to me, but we realize for our listeners down under, he is an important person and he deserves mentioning. He was a mentor to Russell Crowe. In fact, he directed the actor in his film debut. He worked with George Miller by co-directing Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. And then he began his career as an actor, but he was urged to embrace directing. He was a key director at the Melbourne Theatre Company. He directed dozens of shows there, won awards. He directed all or part of some significant 1980s TV miniseries. There was a time in the 70s and into the 80s when miniseries became the big thing. And in Australia, he was really part of that movement. He helped make miniseries very popular in Australia. And this is a kind of a nice grace note. His final role as an actor way late in his life was a small part in the film The Water Diviner, directed by Russell Crowe. So that's a great full circle for him as well. Now, I know you know the next actor and the next person. I'm sure you are a big fan of hers.
Who? You're talking about, you know, Honor Blackman?
Well, of course. A Bond girl, to use the dismissive term we used for decades.
You know, I was never, you know, I couldn't have picked her out of a lineup.
Really?
Necessarily.
Pussy,
yeah, no.
Miss Pussy Galore? One of the most ridiculously over-the-top Bond names ever. She died at 94. She broke through on the hit TV series The Avengers. Hey, if you've never watched it, you really should. Is it available for streaming, Sergio? I don't know. Let's look it up while we talk. Maybe it's available. The Avengers is a great TV show. There was Patrick McNee and a string of women. First was one woman, then she was replaced by Honor Blackman. Then after Honor Blackman left the show was Diana Rigg, perhaps the longest running and most popular of all the Avengers women. But Honor Blackman was a great one. She was there for 2 years and she left the show just as it was going into color and going to be aired on ABC in the United States. So it was just really going to kick into high gear. And you can buy the show on Amazon or Vudu, but you cannot stream it anywhere right now, which is a real shame. You would think maybe one of the BritBox or some of those people might have had access to it. But it's a very fun show. She was a big star on it, became a star, and then she left it for a role. Just the second film, the second James Bond film. So it wasn't the iconic series it was yet, but she left to appear opposite Bond, James Bond, in Goldfinger. She played Miss Pussy Galore, a character who was notably less eager to jump into bed with the secret agent. Indeed, in the novel the film is based on, her character is a lesbian, something the twice-married Blackman relished telling people. And after Bond, she appeared in lots of other films like Jason and the Argonauts. She did steady stage and film work. She did everything from TV's Doctor Who and Coronation Street to West End revivals of The Sound of Music, Cabaret, My Fair Lady. Her biggest post-Bond role was probably the UK sitcom The Upper Hand, which had a 7-season run in the 90s. And that's a remake, a British remake of Who's the Boss, the Tony Danza series.
Which is probably where a lot of people, at least in the United Kingdom, might recall her from.
Well, they know her from Bond, James Bond. She's a beloved.
Yeah, right,
she's a very well-known. Yeah, of course. She had a hit sitcom in the 90s. But she looms larger in the UK than she does in your mind. And if anybody who loves James Bond certainly knows her. But yeah, she played the Catherine Hellman role in that show. So a fun, interesting career. You're a Bond, you're in a Bond film, you live forever. I always, once upon a time, I thought, man, I'd love just to like a one line in a Woody Allen movie, because you know you're going to live forever. Those movies will always be Whoops, watch out. I fucking only could be on the Cosby Show. Oh, whoops.
Yeah, well.
So you never know what's going to happen, but Bond will live forever, and so will Honor Blackman. Then we have three terrific music artists who have died.
Well, Ilyas Marsalis died from coronavirus complications.
Was it coronavirus complications? I didn't know that. Yeah, dear. He was 85. What's he best known for? He's a great pianist. He's played on a number of albums, but...
But I think I read a few of his obituaries, and for the most part, they all said, he is the father of, and they listed all of the Marsalis boys, Wynton and Branford specifically, Wynton Marsalis, the trumpeter, Branford Marsalis, the saxophonist, who are, you know,
towering figures in jazz. Wynton is, of course, done great stuff at Jazz at Lincoln Center. Branford, though, his last album is one of my two or three favorite albums of 2019. Check it out. But Ilyas Marsalis was a great educator as well. So not only was he the father of his biological children, but in many ways, he was a father to a lot of great jazz artists because they came under his tutelage. And he had a great gig for 30 years on Friday nights. You could catch him at Snug Harmer in New Orleans. I wish I'd done it. He retired like a decade ago or something like that from doing that gig, but he did that right up into his 70s, from his 40s to his 70s. He did that every Friday night. That's a real jazz player.
Well, also taking everybody by surprise, Adam Schlesinger. Ugh. Now, if that name sounds familiar or not so familiar, he was one half of the duo Fountains of Wayne. And he also wrote the lyrics and the music for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. He died at the age of 52, also coronavirus complications.
Right. Adam Schlesinger is an EGOT nominee, which is a huge accomplishment. He is a Grammy and multiple Emmy winner, and he's also been nominated for Oscar, which he should have won, and the Tony. So he's one half of Fountains of Wayne. They're best known for their hit Stacy's Mom. But at the same time, he was also in Ivy, another band, and then he was in a supergroup called Tinted Windows years later. Fountains of Wayne especially had a string of great power pop albums. They are all solid and well worth listening to, especially Utopia Parkway and Welcome Interstate Managers. Start at the beginning or go to the second album. Those two or three or four albums, you're going to be very, very happy. He also did something amazing. He co-wrote the insanely catchy hit to order, That Thing You Do. That's the
title. Is that what he was nominated for an Oscar for?
That's right. That's for the title song for the Tom Hanks film, the movie that Tom Hanks directed called That Thing You Do, which was a movie about a 60s band that had a big hit. Right. So basically, you go to these guys and you say, I need a hit song from the early 60s that people can hear 100 times in the movie and not hate by the end of the film. And they'll believe it's a catchy 1960s number that became a huge hit. And it's got to work. And it's got to be great. And you got to do it now. I mean,
and Tom Hanks said after making that movie, he said, you know, That Thing You Do, it's not a kind of thing I want to do. I'm not going to direct another movie.
And he should have, because he directed a fine film and he did a good job at it. Maybe he just didn't enjoy the experience, but he did a good job and it's a good, nice little movie. But that song is great. He lost to Andrew Lloyd Webber, who wrote a new song, Because You Love Me. Is that the name of it? From Evita. They wrote a new number for Madonna to sing, and that song was the end title credits number, I believe, or maybe it was pushed into the middle of the film. But anyway, not a bad song, actually, but That Thing You Do was such a great accomplishment to do that and achieve it, and that foreshadowed what he would do later. Fountains of Wayne went into retirement, and then he became a collaborator on the TV show Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. Most episodes featured one or two or three original comic songs. They wrote 157 songs in all. He co-wrote, I believe, all of them with the star and other people involved in the show. So he co-wrote or wrote 157 songs, and he wrote new wave songs, Broadway, you know, in the styles of reggae and every possible genre you can think of. He would collaborate and create songs that worked for the characters, worked for the scene, worked for the moment, aped a different genre. They were funny. They were catchy. They became YouTube sensations. Amazing, amazing stuff. So the accomplishment on that show, you could see he had a great career ahead of him. And so that's why he was working on Broadway. He did the John Waters musical Crybaby. He was collaborating on a new musical with Sarah Silverman, the new musical The Bedwetter. That was supposed to open this summer regionally before it made its way to Broadway. And then he produced the first album by the Monkees in 20 years. That album was called Good Times. It was also their best. And that actually means something because they had some very good albums later in their 60s and early 70s era. So this really hurts because this guy was just getting going. He had a lot of great stuff coming down the road, a terrific talent who'd explored in new areas. This
and he was in his 50s, so that he's just getting going in his 50s. So you see, you're never too old.
That's right. That really hurts.
Now, speaking of really hurting, Bill Withers, he wrote some songs that I'm sure you know, Lean On Me being one of them, Ain't No Sunshine being another, Lovely Day, Just the Two of Us. I mean, he is the two of us. Yeah, legendary.
Absolutely.
Without a doubt.
Yeah, he died.
He's in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. He stopped just 14 years into his career. He did it until he was like 33, and he was like, yeah, you know what?
No. I'm done. Started at 33. So he died at the age of 81, and he was working in a factory, and he went to a Lou Rawls concert in a club, and Lou Rawls showed up late, and nobody was paying attention to Bill Withers, but when Lou Rawls walked in, all the ladies said, oh, and he said, oh, that looks like a good job. Plus, he heard Lou Rawls was getting paid $2,000 for performing that night. He said, that sounds like a great job. He went out and bought an acoustic guitar in a pawn shop, taught himself to play, and started writing songs. Crazily, somebody heard his music and signed him up, and his debut album was produced by Booker T of Booker T and the MGs. Did a great job on his debut album, Just As I Am. That came out in 1971. It is a classic album. It is so good. I've been listening to his music this week. But his second album, Still Bill, damn near as good. And what happened was he produced 5 albums in a row that were just terrific. The quality level was amazing. He also did a live album at Carnegie Hall that was great. But his record label didn't know what to do with him. He had signed to Columbia. He was treated dismissively and racistly by one of the executives. He says, I don't like any black music. Like, what? What are you doing at a record label? But anyway, he was just thrown this way and that. He took off, I think it was 7 or 8 years before he finally recorded his last album. So there was an 8-year gap until his last album came out in 1985. And even after that, the record company just fumbled it and didn't know what to do with it, even though the quality was still there. And he said, you know what? I'm done. So in 1985, after just 14 years of recording, half of which he didn't record. So half of that time, he just sat there and couldn't get an album out. So we only have 7 studio albums from him, an amazing talent. For decades, I've been hoping he would go back into the studio. I was like, why doesn't Rick Rubin get with this guy? For the love of God, he's so great. But he did 35 years of silence. And you got to respect that. You know, eventually, he could have gone back and recorded. And he felt like, I've done my business. I've done my work. I hate the record industry. What I did is really high quality. I'm going to leave it at that.
The two stories I loved that he would tell is that he was so unrecognizable because he hadn't been doing anything since 1985.
Hey, you've read his obituary. Good for you.
That he would be at like a diner and he'd hear people talking about, I really love that song, Ain't No Sunshine. That is such a good song. Bill Withers, man, whatever happened to him? I love that guy, whatever. And he would be like, oh, I'm going to surprise these people. I'm going to go up and say, well, I'm Bill Withers. And nobody would believe him.
Right. One of the little old ladies said, you're too light-skinned to be Bill Withers. So, he was a coal miner's son, not a coal miner's daughter, but a coal miner's son. And this is great, He was 30 in his 30s and he recorded an album, but who knows if it would get released, how well it would do, what would happen. He was laid off from that factory where he was working a few months before the debut came out. He certainly didn't have enough money to quit. But then on the same day, he got 2 letters in the mail, one asking him to come back to work at the factory, the other one inviting him to come on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. So
I wonder which one he took.
Yes, I wonder. But if you have not listened to Bill Withers, you'll probably go to Lean On Me, his greatest hit set. That's a perfectly good greatest hit set. You'll hear a lot of great songs. But do yourself a favor, if you love popular music, sit down with Just As I Am, his debut album, and start working your way through his catalog. It's really, really great.
And you're really, really great for making it to the end of this show, a show that should have been 10 minutes long and somehow I'm sure will wind up to be over an hour. But you know what? Listen, if you don't want to miss our next show, subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find us. You can rate and review us in those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find those ways to subscribe to us, as well as ways to email us and contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle. We're on Facebook. Facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox is where you can like our page. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's leanonme.com. I should say org.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm sure the .com is taken. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgilt.com?
Oh, I should have said just the two of us. There you go. That's .com. A perfect song for us, Sperling.
There you go. Well, your work is aggregated. All of your entertainment coverage and your entertainment writing at michaelgilt.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
Just the two of us. We can make it if we try. Just the two of us. Backup singing. Hello? Nope. Okay.